Doors to both directions of the 710 are closed. It's 11:06.
Got a friend in me.
Well, and the Pixar films have certainly been friends to kids and adults across the country and around the world. This is Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by animation critic, historian, and author Charles Solomon. He's part of our Film Week team that reviews films. We're going to be spending the beginning portion of Film Week on Air Talk looking at the 22-year history of Pixar Animation, now part of the Walt Disney Company, and arguably the most important part of the company when it comes to movie making. There is a documentary that's out, directed by Leslie Iwerks, that looks at the history of Pixar. It's a totally authorized view of the history of the company. There's an accompanying book to that film, and then an unauthorized book that's just out titled The Pixar Touch by a writer, David Price, who last turned his attention to American history before taking on Pixar. Charles, the timing for this to sort of analyze what Pixar has done is particularly ripe because WALL-E, which is the next in the Pixar series of hits, no misses in its history, that comes out in a couple weeks.
2 weeks, and they just unveiled a new short at the Annecy Film Festival. Pixar has done what even Walt didn't succeed in doing. They've had 8 smash hits in a row.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, they've never made a bad movie. I mean, there are lesser and greater within that canon, certainly. But they've really kind of replaced Disney as the brand people look to now when you want a really charming film, you want warmth, you want something that will touch you, you want a well-told story, you want characters you'll care about, you want cutting-edge technology, state-of-the-art animation. You think Pixar now.
And it's funny because I think many people would have expected you need hand-drawn animation to bring that level of emotional involvement to a character, that to really feel the character, to believe in them, that you'd have to have it hand-drawn. And Pixar showed that, no, the humanity of the characters in the writing, not the technology used to draw the character.
I think that's very true. And part of that is that John Lasseter and his artists aren't afraid to do what Disney himself did, which is to balance a laugh with a tear. You know, what's more poignant than Jessie's song in Toy Story 2 when she recalls how she had been loved and then was abandoned? And the story I heard is that when they pitched the boards for that sequence to John, he said, "That's the saddest thing I've ever seen," and immediately put it into production. I also think their animation has gotten more subtle and closer to drawn animation, particularly if you look at Ratatouille. The sequence when Remy is in the bottle and Linguini is going to toss him in the Seine and starts talking to him. He's just nodding and shaking his head, and Linguini saying, "What did you put in there? Rosemary? Is rosemary a spice?" And then he realizes the rat is nodding and understanding. You know what that little character is thinking, the same way you know what Jiminy Cricket is thinking or what Gromit is thinking when he looks up from his knitting.
I'd love to ask our Film Week listeners, and so many of whom are really students of film, love movies, and are wanting to see the highest quality possible, what do you think that other studios, what other producers and filmmakers could learn from Pixar? Is there something in Pixar's vision, in its artistry, that can be done elsewhere? 866-893-KPCC. And I'm not talking specifically about animation. I'm talking about making movies, whether it's live action, whether it's documentaries, whether it's animation. 866-893-5722. Perhaps you're someone who creatively works in the business, and you can point out some of the impediments to that happening elsewhere in Hollywood. Because a string of 8 for 8 in movie making, it has got to be unprecedented. It's an extraordinary output. And perhaps part of it is that in this long period of time, they've only done 8 full-length features, so quality control is possible. But what a payoff on that investment. 866-893-KPCC.
Well, also, Larry, you should hear from some animators. You have a very large following among them.
Yeah, we have so many in the audience, yeah.
And one thing that the Pixar model suggests is that you let let artists run the studio rather than suits and executives. There are probably the three most admired studios in the world are Pixar, Aardman Animation in Britain, creator of Wallace and Gromit,
sure,
and Ghibli Studio in Tokyo, the home of Miyazaki. Artists running all three, and they don't have a lot of suits niggling and telling them, oh, this tests better as a gag, or, oh, we think we can market this better. You have people who believe in something, talented artists, coming together, honing their talents on each other, and making films they actually believe in. And I think particularly in animation, an audience can sense when it's being lied to or when the artists don't believe in what they're doing, that you have to believe in what you're animating or it won't convince the audience. Somehow that sincerity or lack of it will show. And in all three cases, there are people who do believe in what they do, and the resulting films are the best being done.
You know, one of the problems, I think, in animation, aside from Pixar, is you get so much Me Too-ism. You know, if it's talking animals in one and they're wisecracking and it's frenetic action and that's successful in a film, well, then everybody ends up doing it. And it's so derivative. And it seems such a waste to me, because animators are such great artists, that to have them just imitating the last box office success that came out, I realize that's what's done in live action as well, but what a terrible model to follow.
Really, including the sort of sitcom dialogue idea that you have characters who do nothing but wisecrack. When you look at the classic animated films, whether Pixar and Toy Story and The Iron Giant or Spirited Away, or you want to go back to the early films of Walt Disney, the characters don't talk that much, and they say things they really believe in. The humor comes out of the characters and the situation they find themselves in. Think of Bambi and Thumper on the ice, you know, skating around, or Dumbo's pink elephants, or think of Ellen DeGeneres in Finding Nemo announcing she speaks whale. And they're all hilarious moments. But it's not that kind of sitcom, yeah. Take my wife, please.
Well, it's grounded in real experience, so that even if it's a talking fish, you as a human being can somehow relate to that as a character that's believable. I mean, and that suspension of disbelief allows a level of emotional buy-in that's going to make those movies connect so much more with the audience. So I'd love to hear, as Charles just said, animators, creative folks in the industry, 866-893-5722. Let's talk about the history of Pixar and see, Charles, you know, what, if anything, we can learn there about its evolution and its success. It sort of has its origins, I guess, both in the University of Utah and the New York Institute of Technology.
Yeah, both places that were early explorers of computer graphics. One weakness in both of the books about Pixar is they don't talk about there was computer animation before then, both being explored technically at Bell Labs and artistically by people like John Whitney, the local filmmaker and animator, his brother James, and even at the National Film Board of Canada. But it was through these universities that the systems that we've come to use were developed. But what I think is most instructive about Pixar's model is that, like Walt Disney, John Lasseter spent 10 years making short films and learning this is what the medium can do. These are the tools we need to do the things I want to do. These are the weaknesses of the medium, so that when Toy Story came along, his crew was sort of primed and ready, just as the artists were to begin Snow White. Instead of just taking artists who have been doing special effects and Spider-Man swinging through the skyscrapers or Hulk ripping his pants apart, you have artists who have been really trying to explore character and emotion and storytelling, and they can go and do it and do it well.
Well, I'm wondering, for example, with Disney's best films, I mean, you have like Joe Grant, who's mm-hmm. a story man, and how important it is to have someone like that, whether it's an animator who can also do stories mm-hmm. or whether it's someone who specializes in that. I mean, is that the ultimate essential?
Yes. I mean, the artists at Pixar all looked very much to Joe Grant as one of their inspirations, who, you know, had co-written Dumbo and designed The Queen and the Witch and Snow White and helped pick music for Fantasia. And Pixar has what they call their brain trust that are some of their top artists, people like Brad Bird and Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton. And they go over the projects in the works and, you know, review it and say, okay, this isn't working. How can we make it better? It's not a question of I can do this better. It's how can we make it better? And it's a very communal kind of idea with artists, including they also had one of the greatest story artists of his generation, Joe Ranft, who was killed tragically finishing up on Cars.
Yeah, and in fact was killed before the film was even done.
Yeah.
Matthew and Corona, you're on Air Talk with animation expert Charles Solomon. Hi.
Nice to hear from you guys. I'd like to comment on that question.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I think that Pixar, I've seen how they work. They have a really good working environment. I've seen people on scooters there. A lot of people seem like they are very happy. That may contribute to why, you know, they have good movies and everything. Yet you have, like, set dates for live movies, everything. These people go where they want to go. You know, set dates are not a problem.
Oh, yes. Like yes. That. Actually, they do have very rigorous deadlines and often have to work horrendous overtime. But it's in an atmosphere where you feel you're contributing to the film. You're not just turning dials or punching in numbers or moving your mouse. You're making a contribution to something, and it's in an atmosphere where you can have fun. And there's that enormous foyer when you first walk into the Pixar studio. And, yeah, people ride little scooters or skateboard or whatever through it. Or, you know, nobody wears a suit to Pixar. I've never seen John Lasseter in anything but a Hawaiian shirt.
I think he sleeps in a Hawaiian shirt, right? Never seen him out of there. I appreciate your call. Thanks, Matthew. Well, and is there a risk-taking factor to this? Because when I think of, you know, the giants of early film, for example, you know, risk-taking seemed to be huge. And I wonder if that, you know, Pixar, when it started out, kind of had nothing to lose and encouraged risks.
Well, they did to a degree. I mean, they had been doing some shorts, some special effects, and suddenly they were given the chance to do a feature that they originally thought of as a TV special. And they ran with it. But there's a risk, you know, in doing what you want. But that's what the great filmmakers all do, whether you're talking about Chaplin and Keaton or D.W. Griffith or John Lasseter and Pete Docter and Brad Bird.
And the thing about Lasseter that's so impressive, he has such a clear artistic vision, but likes being surrounded by other people who have very distinct and strong-willed artistic visions as well. Charles Solomon with us. We'll continue talking about the Pixar story, how the animation studio came to be a giant creatively and in box office success. This is Film Week on Air Talk.
Programming is supported by the Southern California Mercedes-Benz dealers, offering test drives of their M-Class luxury SUV. Online visitors can build their own vans at mbsocal.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Well, we've heard that high gas prices are driving commuters out of their cars and onto mass transit. KPCC's Brian Watt found proof.
Ridership on Metro's two subway lines and three light rail lines was up 6% last month over the same period last year. The agency says that's one of the highest spikes ever. A one-way fare on Metro rail lines costs $1.25. That's almost a quarter of what some Southlanders are paying for a gallon of gas. At $5, the Metro day pass for rail and buses comes close to the price of that gallon. Metro officials say the system's gold line saw the biggest jump last month as more people decided to ride the rails between Pasadena and downtown Los Angeles. The agency expects even more riders once it's finished the gold line extension to East L.A. next year and opens the Expo line between downtown L.A. and Culver City a couple of years from now. Brian Watt, 89.3 KPCC.
Free drug treatment making a difference for AIDS patients in Africa. A photographer wanted to capture that difference on film. We'll hear that story on The World at noon here on KPCC.
programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, presenting the 14th recent Spanish Cinema Festival, featuring 12 U.S. and Los Angeles premieres of new films from Spain. Actors and directors will appear in person with these International Film Festival and Goya Award winners. June 12th to the 22nd, online at EgyptianTheater.com.
It's one thing you have to remember, Randy Newman scores for so many of the Pixar films, which have left an indelible impression, as have the characters and stories in Pixar films. We're talking about the Pixar success story. I shudder to use the word formula because clearly the lack of there being a formula when it comes to the films has been to its advantage, but there are also consistencies within the Pixar framework that have made a huge difference. Animation critic, historian, and author Charles Solomon with us as well. Bill in West Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk. Hi, Bill. Nope, we don't have you. Okay. Marshall in San Juan Capistrano, you're on Air Talk.
Thanks very much, Larry, and thanks to your guest as well. Being a child that grew up in the classic Warner Brothers era of 1940s and 1950s and growing up and living genius of Jay Ward and into the Pixar age, I must say that I completely agree with Pixar's vision that story is king and that without good telling of tales, the technical feats of animation are going to go nowhere, and Pixar has all their eggs in the right basket there. The story is king. I must say that the expression afforded by the wonderful artists at Pixar leaves nothing to be desired. It's as powerful and perhaps even more so compared to the hand animation age. And I also say that I go back and already revisit Pixar films because they've become close to my heart and my mind in enjoying the wonderful creativeness and also the way I'm moved. I identify with the Jesse's song. It's just done so well.
It is. Marshall, thank you for your call. And these are films that hold up very well on repeat viewings.
And a good animated film you can watch over and over again pretty much forever. You know, we're still watching, as he mentioned, the Warner Brothers shorts that are, you know, 50 years old now. They're still funny.
Yeah.
And certainly in Incredibles and Ratatouille, Brad Bird brought a much more dynamic style of animation that's a bit cartoonier. But the problem that we were talking about before with many of the characters just doing shtick, 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 talking, 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 is they become so hip and so fly and so cool. They don't seem to believe the story they're in. Mm-hmm. So how can the audience?
Yeah, there's an emotional disconnect. So you're there for the laughs, not because the characters really connect on a heart level. Let's get back to the history of Pixar. So you have in these dual locations further development of computer animation, University of Utah, New York Institute of Technology. How then does George Lucas factor into this?
Well, Lucas was interested in streamlining and modernizing the filmmaking process, and he felt that computers were a way to do it. And so he set up what was essentially a computer research branch for a time. One of the things that they produced that both books mention is the edit droid system. That was what they don't seem to realize, though, is how ahead of its time this was. Although it used laser discs rather than digital information, it was essentially a digital computer editing system that anticipated the kind of digital editing that is standard now in the film industry. And this was a huge jump, but no one was quite ready to make that leap yet or was sure that laser disc technology was going to stay around. So the edit droids didn't really go anywhere. Another project Pixar was involved in with some of the artists at Disney was CAPS, computer-assisted animation program, I think it is, that was the first system to use computers for ink and paint. And they used that on the very end of The Little Mermaid, and then all of Rescuers Down Under was done that way. And it saved a fortune. Instead of doing, you know, hand tracing the animators' drawings or Xeroxing them and then painting the cells, you could just go into the computer and with a mouse and, you know, hit areas.
Sure, yeah.
And it made it much easier to do airbrushy effects or other thing, colored lines that would be very expensive to do otherwise. And so, again, this was a way of streamlining and updating. And Roy Disney tells the story that when they had finally agreed to do this, when the Pixar people came, and, you know, kind of a ragtag bunch at that point, he went with them to Frank Wells' office and was standing at the back of it. And Frank asked them, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I just want to make sure you sign that check."
We're speaking with Charles Solomon, talking about the history of Pixar Animation. We are focused on the history of the company as well as how it's able to do what it does so well. So George Lucas comes into the picture, and a division of his Industrial Light and Magic is devoted to experimentation in
I'm
this?
I'm not sure if it's under ILM or under Lucasfilm or how, you know, that
how
particularly
that's,
involved.
Corporately set up, yeah.
But then when he began to feel he couldn't afford to keep, you know, several million dollars going just for R&D, they offered it to Disney, who could have bought it, I think, for about $15 million at one point. And Disney said no, and they would later pay $7.5 billion for it. Steve Jobs was on the outs at Apple and had money and was curious and got interested in this and bought the company for $5 million and committed another $5 million to its development. And in the To Infinity and Beyond book, they even include a copy of the check, you know, that he had signed for $5 million.
And how funny. I wanted to ask you about Jobs, because, I mean, the impression of him is that he can be a little mercurial and you know, tempestuous in some ways. But here you have Lasseter, who doesn't give that impression. I don't know him. But how have they been able to work together so well?
I think mutual respect and trust. And you also have the third figure there of Ed Catmull, who, like Frank Wells, is someone who doesn't, you know, come out in the public a lot. He's not a front man, but he's very good at making sure that everything stays within its proper orbit and everything is balanced and peace and, you know, work are going on as they should. So the three of them work very well together, just to say Katzenberg, Eisner, and Wells did when Wells was alive. It was after Wells was killed in the helicopter accident that things begin to fall apart at Disney.
Yeah, he was the lubricant, it seemed, between those two more difficult personalities. We have Edie McClurg with us from Hollywood, who was a voice in Cars and A Bug's Life. Hi, Edie.
Hello there.
Hi. What was it like working on those films?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, people talk about computer animation, but the thing is that all of these, the creations are done by artists from their hand with great big, you know, pulp paper sketch pads. So it all starts, you know, with the artist and the soul of the artist working on it. And then there is collaboration with other people in the pod, if you will, working on that particular film. There's a lot of input from a lot of good minds, and people are not territorial about what I did, what you did. It was what we do. And I visited up in Emeryville and saw the plant there and had lunch with some of the folks. And it was just, it does feel like a kind of a crazy campus, but they get so much work done. And each of the artists has their own space that they can decorate any way they want. Some people,
and do.
Yes. There's one, like, it looks like a little shack on the bayou, and that's he's allowed that amount of space, and he can do with it what he wishes, because they often spend, well, 18 to 20 hours at a stretch, you know. So they have to make them happy while they're doing that. And from my viewpoint, doing the voiceover of Dr. Plora in A Bug's Life and one of the minivans in Cars.
Yeah, you got lost in Cars, didn't you?
We
went off-roading a bit.
Richard Kind and I played the minivans who got lost off the interstate and end up in Radiator Springs and then off into the desert. And in the script, we were just Minivan 1 and Minivan 2. And Joe Ranft, it was the last time I worked with him. He was directing with John Lasseter in the session. And I said, well, I need to call my husband something. What are our first names? And he said, well, we really don't have any. So we all just kind of stood there looking at the floor. And I said, I'm Minnie, and he's Van.
Very good.
And everybody went huzzah, and we proceeded forward. And it was just so much fun. And while we were being threatened on the interstate by big trucks and frightened, John and Joe ran back and forth between our little booths, threatening us so that we would
get
have
you in character.
Reactions. So it was a full-on improvisation, Edie, and it ended up in the film.
Edie, thank you. I love hearing that anecdote about the making of Cars and what it was like working on those films. We hope that we'll hear you in many more of the Pixar films to come. Edie McClurg, thanks so much for being with us. Sue in Burbank, we don't have time to put her on, but she wanted to say, great thing about Pixar, they do not dumb down the films. They work for kids and adults. And that is, of course, what the early and best Disney films did too, Charles.
Yeah, and the Warner's cartoons. The idea was that they should appeal to the least sophisticated member of the audience and the most sophisticated member of the audience. It's also something Jay Ward believed in or The Simpsons believed in.
And we'll hope that WALL-E coming out in 2 weeks continues with Pixar's level of success. This is Film Week on Air Talk on KPCC. This is Film Week on Air Talk. Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Gene Oppenheimer of Village Voice Media, Andy Klein with us from City Beat, and Charles Solomon continues from Amazon.com. We begin with the apocalyptic R-rated M. Night Shyamalan film, The Happening. In this scene, Mark Wahlberg's character Elliot has just stopped on a train in the middle of nowhere. The passengers don't know why they've stopped. And Wahlberg's character questions the conductor, played by Darej Harding.
Until we hear from this,
sir,
train service has been discontinued. This will be the last stop for all passengers.
Well, hey, what do you mean? Where are we?
Filbert, Pennsylvania.
Filbert? Does anybody know where that is? Why are you giving me one useless piece of information at a time? What's going on? Hey, why would you just stop? You can't just leave us here.
Sir, we lost contact.
With who?
Everyone.
The Happening from M. Night Shyamalan, starring Mark Wahlberg, Zooey Deschanel, and John Leguizamo, the film rated R. Andy, what'd you think?
I'm going to be down the middle on this, and it certainly is not great. It is a step up from Lady in the Water, which
okay. Is that an endorsement?
Boy, is that,
that would count as faint praise, I guess. This film is very derivative of The Birds, and The Birds is a nice model. You know, it really is The Birds without The Birds, which is, I think, kind of interesting because it means instead of having a visible threat, you have a threat that you can barely see. Having said that, he never generates quite as much fear as Hitchcock, or close to, I guess, though enough that it kept me interested. It also tends to be more, I don't want to say formulaic, but a little flatter at the end. It kind of works things out too logically where The Birds left you hanging.
Jean? I think he's being generous. He's down the middle on it. I'm just down on this film. I really wanted to like it. I like Shalman's work. I thought, obviously, The Sixth Sense was one of the cleverest, most engrossing, really involving films ever. I really like Signs. That one to me it was creepy, it was suspenseful, and it was funny, and they almost, and don't say anything because we're not discussing that film at length. Okay. And the village, which I don't think worked in the long run, at least the one thing that I think he has always been, has a real talent for and always been great at, is creating atmosphere. And to me, unlike Andy, this film had no
atmosphere. It didn't
atmosphere.
Have that, Andy? It didn't have atmosphere?
I actually did think it had some atmosphere. Admittedly, not on the level of even The Village, which I thought was a very flawed film. But I saw some look, I think the guy, even though his scripts have gotten less impressive, that he's in many ways a terrific director of scenes. The mood, the way things are staged, I think he's great at. And in Lady in the Water, I saw none of that. And here I did see some of it, though still not up to his original level.
And the idea of this film is that people just inexplicably start committing suicide?
Well, it's only inexplicable for about 10 minutes. That's one of the interesting things here. There's no surprise.
Yeah, no
Very
twist.
Early on, a theory is given as to what's going
what's,
on that turns out to be the right theory, pretty as far as we ever know.
Right. So there's no like twist in, like in some of his other films. But I think, you know, it's funny watching it. I wrote in my notes, why did The Birds work so well and this isn't? And another film I would draw it to that it did not match up to was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Because here you never get a sense of danger, of suspense, of something taking over people's bodies the way you did in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the first one, the Don Siegel one. I thought the acting was dreadful in this. Mark Wahlberg, Zooey Deschanel, two really good actors. Man, they were in slow motion or emotional slow motion. The writing, I mean, everybody knows.
I
didn't think it was nearly that bad. All I can say, all these things did not bother me so much, and I obviously got more thrills than you did.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I think he's a very talented director, and this did not work for me on absolutely any level.
The Happening, from M. Night Shyamalan, who wrote and directed it, the film rated R. The Incredible Hulk, just a few years after Ang Lee's version, is back as a character. Edward Norton starring as scientist Bruce Banner trying to find a cure for his own alter ego, driven by his own anger. Liv Tyler, Tim Roth, and William Hurt co-star. Louis Leterrier is the director of the film. And Edward Norton co-wrote the screenplay for the film. It's rated PG-13. Jean, what'd you think?
I have two words to say for this film, and they are not Iron Man. They are Jurassic Park, which to me had the best special effects of any film I've ever seen. I really thought they were dinosaurs. My mouth was just open through that whole thing, no matter how many times I've seen that film. My big complaint in the Hulk film, Edward Norton I like very much as an actor. When it's on him, it's fine. But I don't get off on seeing these big plastic things running around. It was so phony.
What'd you think, Amy?
I actually enjoyed this. I did not think it was up to the level, say, of Batman Begins or the first couple Spider-Man films. But I actually enjoyed it more than Ang Lee's film. I think Ang Lee's film was
That's
much
not
more,
hard to do,
well,
Andy.
I mean, but that was an interesting, ambitious film. This is only going for thrills.
Hold that thought. We'll continue. Film Week on Air Talk with our critics Andy Klein, Gene Oppenheimer, and Charles Solomon. Reviews of Savage Grace, Quid Pro Quo, and more films on Film Week on Air Talk.
Little League, music lessons, summer camp. Raising kids costs real money. For some, those costs include wheelchairs, medication, and regular therapy.
When I found out Daniel had cerebral palsy, Dylan was diagnosed with ADD. A month later, I was told Dakota was mentally retarded.
Kathy Harvey is raising three disabled children. She gets most of their medical and social services for free. Listen for her story next week on 89.3 KPCC.
This is 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. More than half of Iowa's counties have been declared state disaster areas because of flooding. The governor will be giving the head of FEMA a firsthand look at the damage today. Thousands of homes have been evacuated. California corrections officials are considering a request by former Manson follower and convicted murderer Susan Atkins to be released from prison because of a terminal illness. The Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says a request was made last month after a doctor determined she had less than 6 months to live. Sources close to the case say Atkins has suffered from brain cancer and has had one of her legs amputated. The 59-year-old has been in prison 37 years. That's longer than any other woman in California. In Inglewood right now, the 405 North is slow from Manchester to Olympic. In Woodland Hills, the 101 North past Winnetka has the left lane and far right lanes blocked. With a crash, it's slow from Tampa. 1141.
Thank you. Members like you helped us reach our drive goals last month and meet a $30,000 challenge. Thanks so much for your generous support. Listeners like you are KPCC's main source of funding, so we can bring you the news you count on. If you're not a member yet, or it's time for you to renew, contribute today to make sure we end this fiscal year well prepared for the months ahead. It's quick and easy to give online at kpcc.org, and thanks again.
This is Film Week on Air Talk. Larry Mantle with Charles Solomon, Gene Oppenheimer, and Andy Klein. The Incredible Hulk, directed by Louis Leterrier, starring Edward Norton, Liv Tyler, Tim Roth, and William Hurt, rated PG-13. Gene, not sold on this film, but Andy, again, sees it as kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, I do. I mean, yeah, the CGI is ridiculous looking, and those scenes aren't as exciting as I would have liked, but their
Plastic
chases,
Man, as Gene put it, yeah. I think that's.
But gee, and it like was made on such a shoestring.
Plastic was all they could.
The first chase scene, which is mostly before he turns into Hulk during that scene, I thought was terrific. I mean, that stuff got me.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the editing on that, the number of shots, that was very well done. And again, when Edward Norton was on, I thought he did a very good job of making this a very psychological film.
All right. The film, again, The Incredible Hulk. Savage Grace is a dramatization of the story of plastics heir.
Speaking of plastics.
Yes, speaking of plastics, yeah, but not people, although we'll find out. Anthony Bakeland and his mother, Barbara, who in addition to being son and mother, were also lovers. Julianne Moore, Stephen Delane, Eddie Redmayne star in the film, which is directed by Tom Kalin, and it's adapted from a book that tells the story. In this scene, young Tony, played by Barney Clark, has just brought his mother, Julianne Moore, breakfast in bed. After learning that his parent will be out for the evening, Tony tries to strike a bargain with his mother.
You won't be alone. You'll be with Clotilde.
Well, maybe since I'll be your boy in Clotilde, you can balance it out with something more fun during the day.
I see where this is going. Your mother needs time to paint.
I would like to go on the Ferris wheel.
Really?
And then for lunch, I would like some ice cream.
Ah, but you had ice cream for breakfast.
Please don't tell Papa.
I won't. It will be our secret, as will the aspirins you're going to fetch from the cabin.
From the bathroom. Next to the sink.
Your mother has a shocking hangover.
Savage Grace, Julianne Moore, Stephen Delane, Eddie Redmayne. Gene, this sounds like a story be pretty unpleasant.
What Mama wants, Mama gets. it is more than unpleasant. It is tawdry. It is perverse. I found it actually very difficult to watch the whole. I don't know. Did you actually refer to what the relationship
that they were lovers,
had, that they were lovers, yes. I found that very, very difficult to watch. I didn't think there was as much insight psychologically as there should be in the film. And Julianne Moore, I thought, was very unconvincing in the first half of the movie. And I thought in the second half she got a lot more convincing. But then you're just put off by this really tawdry, sickening, disgusting, revolting story.
So there's nothing redeeming in it, no psychological insights to speak of.
No incest insights.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know that she wants love, that she's a social climber, that she has this, you know, put on fake accent because she's trying to be accepted by the rich. But none of it can really, to me, explain how depraved she is.
All right. Savage Grace, Julianne Moore, starring Tom Kalin, the director. Quid Pro Quo stars Nick Stahl and Vera Farmiga in a film written and directed by Carlos Brooks. It's the story of a wheelchair-bound National Public Radio reporter who discovers a group of healthy people who want to be disabled. Bizarre premise. The film is rated R. Andy?
Yeah, it turns out there is such a disorder, which
really?
I found hard to believe. But it's much like people who want limbs amputated, body identity integrity disorder. And I was afraid this was going to be just like David Cronenberg's Crash from about 10 years ago, which I hated, which just to me was like the characters were all from Mars. That's not the case here. This is a much more – the plot here is a little more contrived than Crash. But I thought it was very clever how it worked out, and there are a couple of plot things that I was genuinely surprised by. So I enjoyed this a lot.
Now, Vera Farmiga is an actress I know has been very well reviewed in other films she's been in by many of you. Does she deliver the goods here?
She does. She plays this mysterious, sexy woman. I thought the film started out well. I had more problems with it than Andy, who seems to be going down the middle of the road on every film today.
He's an easy sell.
Yeah.
But the first half hour to me, when you think that it's going to be a little bit more like David Cronenberg's Crash, where do these people get off on maybe does she want to have sex with the guy who's in a wheelchair? What's going on? And that really all is a tease. It ends up being about something else, something that is actually – more interesting, but the fact that the story shifts gears in the middle, I think, hurts it. And there's also something that happens later on that I was confused about.
Yeah, I actually I think the shifting of gears is exactly what made it interesting. I really like that.
Isn't John Hockenberry on NPR in a wheelchair?
John Hockenberry has worked for NPR. Yes, he has.
Mm-hmm. I guess I thought the transition was bumpy. And so my bigger complaint is something that happens later in the film that can't be discussed.
Okay. Right. There's a significant twist in the film. Is that correct?
Yes.
Just something that,
okay. Quid pro quo. So again, Andy lukewarm on the film. Jean not pleased. She's tough.
No, Andy likes it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Definitely.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
I
mixed.
Really like this.
I'm mixed. I do think it had some good things.
Okay. Raised your thoughts on this. Nick Stahl, Vera Farmiga in the film written and directed by Carlos Brooks, quid pro quo. Meet Bill is the story of Bill, played by Aaron Eckhart, a married man fed up with his life, turns things around with the help of a self-assured boy and a cute lingerie sales girl, played by Jessica Alba. The film is directed by Bernie Goldman and Melissa Wallach. Wallach wrote the screenplay. In this scene, Eckhart's Bill explains work to the teenage boy he's mentoring.
Bill, why do you want a donut store? This place sucks.
Let me tell you something, kid. Working sucks, okay? Working sucks. And it doesn't matter if you're in a bank, a department store, or a donut factory. Because once you've been there long enough, the only thing you'll care about is when your next pay increase is, how many vacation days you've accrued, and if your health insurance is going to pay for the cholesterol medicine that keeps your heart pumping no matter how much you work through it. Then, after you've gained 20 or 30 pounds because you're so tight all the time, you wake up and discover that you're working for your father-in-law in a position with a gratuitous title and you're totally replaceable. And not only is the new guy better at your job, but he's got a better car and better jokes and better hair. So no matter what you do, you make sure you make a lot of money doing it because it all sucks.
Meet Bill, Gene.
Well, now you don't have to see the movie.
That wasn't a promising clip.
I thought this was really weak. I mean, the story, I didn't buy Eckhart, who's a wonderful actor in this part. I thought it was just, I don't know, it was just very uninteresting. The only thing that I would give a plus to is Logan Lerman, who plays the young teenage boy who's being mentored. And here, of course, Eckhart's supposed to mentor him, but the roles get reversed, of course, and it's the kid who's supremely confident, you know, who mentors, in fact, the adult. And Logan Lerman, to me, was a cross between a young Christian Slater and Emil Hirsch. He played Christian Bale's son in 310 to Yuma, plays a very different character here.
On this one, I totally agree with Jeannie, except that I actually bought Eckhart in the role and kind of enjoyed seeing him doing what's a 180-degree turn for him in terms of the character. It's just not funny. The directors do not have a good sense of comic timing. The plot is totally contrived. And, you know, if this had been riotously funny, I would have overlooked a lot of other things. But it's very limp.
And so the idea is it's a full-on comedy, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Meet Bill, starring Aaron Eckhart, Jessica Alba, Elizabeth Banks and young Logan Lerman, directed by Bernie Goldman and Melissa Wallach. It's rated R. The animation show 4 is Mike Judge's compilation of animated shorts that have been done by a variety of different artists. Over 24 films are included here. Bill Plimpton is included, along with other notables. And our Charles Solomon has seen the animation show 4, which is at the New Art Theater next Thursday. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I've never been a fan of Beavis and Butthead or King of the Hill, but I have enormous respect for Mike Judge for giving something back to animation and, you know, putting his money and his name and getting the show together every year. I think it's a really admirable thing for it to do. The films themselves are kind of a mixed bag. There are a few things like Je by the Swiss animator Georges, I think it's Schwiesgebel. A lot of people expected to be nominated for an Oscar, although it's similar to his early work. There's a joyousness to the movement, and it just makes a nice little statement in its own right. John and Karen was also expected. This is a film by Matthew Walker about a polar bear apologizing to his penguin friend. And Hot Dog, which is Bill Plimpton's third bouncy dog short, is lots of fun. And Western Spaghetti, this is a film by a group that calls itself PES or PES. It's a very clever use of stop motion. It's like Jane Aaron's films, only good. Some of the other things, I think, run more towards the pointless and gross in the sick and twisted Mike and Spike tradition. They just don't seem to go much of anywhere. Yompy, the crotch-biting sloop, for example, is not something you really want to take home and think about a great deal.
And there are three
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, where the title yes. would be so appealing. I'm yes. really surprised.
It's the same yes. joke in each one.
Yeah.
Andy, what do you think? What do you think of the animation show?
I also thought it was a mixed bag. For me, the big difference here from previous years, Don Hertzfeldt was no longer involved in doing this, and that may be why this is much more heavily weighted towards just going for laughs rather than having sort of the quote unquote serious art stuff, which for me is a plus. And I think we've had fights over some of this stuff over the years. But yeah, I agree with those. I also liked Angry Unpaid Hooker, which apparently is being spun off into a TV series.
Well, you know, there's nothing like good taste, and that's nothing like good taste.
Crotch-biting, angry hookers, gosh.
There was really no reason to animate that film.
That's true. It was like a stand-up routine with pictures, absolutely.
Yeah, and not many pictures.
The animation show 4 is at the New Art in West Los Angeles. Times and Winds is a Turkish film, the story of three young teenage boys in a poor Turkish village. Written and directed by Rhea Erdem. It's at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Jean, I know you were impressed with this quick word on
this. This is one of the most exceptional films you will see all year. It's a must-see. It's stunning. It's emotionally involving. It's heartbreaking. It's a portrait of life and the struggles of life and these kids and their friendship and how difficult it is. The parents aren't very nice to the kids. The music has a spiritual quality, this deep, sonorous cello music. My two favorite films of the year have been this, which is a Turkish film, and The Edge of Heaven, which was also a Turkish film. I really think this is a must-see.
All right, Times and Winds. It's at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and the film is unrated. Well, the 23rd Israel Film Festival is kicking off. Israeli films have been in the spotlight lately. Beaufort nominated for an Academy Award. The Band's Visit receiving critical acclaim. The Israeli film Anthem was a big winner at the Cannes Film Festival. The 23rd Israel Film Festival opened yesterday and runs through Thursday the 26th, and it's celebrating Israel's 60th anniversary. The founder and executive director of the festival, Meir Fenigstein, joins us on Air Talk. Meir, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, share with us what you have in the way of programming for the festival that's particularly related to the 60th anniversary.
First, we divided into kind of three categories. We have new films that we are featuring as a regular every year in the festival. And we have a major, big retrospective of film for the past 60 years with almost 30 films from 1962 up till today. films that never been shown in the United States on the big screen. Even Israeli U.S. premieres, some of the films even not been shown in Israel. An example, a documentary called Ben-Gurion Remembers opened at the day of the Yom Kippur War in the theaters and was shut down because of the war. And from that time, never been seen on the screen. Very powerful documentary. So we have really a great lineup of films in three locations in the Valley and Lemley Fallbrook Theater. We're showing it also at the Royal Theaters, where we're going to open tomorrow with Noodle, the Los Angeles premiere. We showed it in New York just a few months ago. All the screenings were sold out. We added another screening at 11 a.m., and it was sold out with no advertising. So powerful is Noodle.
Wow. So you've got, you said, three theaters in the Valley at the Fallbrook?
No, one theater in the Valley at Fallbrook in West Hills.
West Hills, okay.
One theater for 1 week at the Royal
In West L.A.
West L.A., and two theaters that are running parallel at the Sunset 5 Theater in West Hollywood.
Okay.
Where we're going to show new films, documentary films with some Israeli filmmakers just arrived from Israel to introduce their films, and we're going to show some of the old films. So it's really, really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have to see so many Israeli films. We're showing, by the way, what we call the Magnificent Seventh, seven Israeli Academy Awards. Probably nobody knew that Israel... on seven Israeli Academy Awards.
Yeah, I didn't, yeah.
Did you know that?
I didn't, no.
I can tell you that in 1971, Israel owned, with The Policeman, Ephraim Kishon's film, the second Academy Award. In 1964, with Salah, with Topol, the first Academy Award. And then in 1972 and 73, in 3 years in a row, we had three Academy Awards. The third one was I Love You, Rosa, by Moshe Mizrahi, and the fourth one was also by Moshe Mizrahi, The House of Shiloh Street.
So you'll be showing all these films as a part of the festival. What's your website for people who'd like information on the screenings?
www.israelfilmfestival.com.
All right, IsraelFilmFestival.com. Mayor Fenickstein, thank you for talking with us about this year's 23rd festival and how it's being tied into the 60th anniversary of Israel as well. Also, thanks to our terrific critics, Charles Solomon of Amazon.com, Andy Klein of CityBeat, and Gene Oppenheimer of Village Voice Media. This is my weekly opportunity to thank the best production team in the business. Senior producer Linda Othen and Gerard. Producers Jackie O'Clery, Mindy Steinman, and Chumi Paul. And also thanks to Doug Gary, terrific director and engineer of Every Day's program as well, with the assistance of Tony Federico. Have a wonderful weekend. I am on vacation on an Alaskan cruise all next week. I will be back with you.